Happen with Reef Bum is sponsored by Polo Reef, Champion Lighting and Supply, and Polyp Lab. Hey, hey, what's happening, everybody? And welcome back to another episode of Rapping with Reef Bum. I'm your host, Keith Burklehammer. So, we are not live. This is the first time after 198 live episodes that we're going to do a recorded version of this show. So, curious to hear your thoughts on that. If you want to put them down in the comments below, that would be cool. It's going to allow us to have more guests outside of the U.S. on the show potentially, because they won't be asleep when we're typically on here on the East Coast of the United States. So my guest on the show today will be Doug Dorrit, who is the owner and operator of Frag Farm UK. But before we start chatting with Doug, I want to take care of some business and thank the sponsors of the show, Polar Reef. Make sure to check out Polar Reef's new YouTube video that drops this Friday, where the Polo team goes over updates from the infamous 900-gallon glass drop down from breaking in transit, then redelivered the scape and inhabitants. Find out what's been going on with this crazy aquarium. Make sure to subscribe to their YouTube channel at Polar Reef for video drop notifications. Champion Lighting and Supply, besides being a place for hobbyists to purchase saltwater aquarium supplies online, Champion Lighting is also a wholesale distributor for many popular brands. If you own an aquarium store or an aquarium service company, contact Champion Lighting through their website at championlighting.com to set up a wholesale account. Polyp Lab, they do their part by being ecologically responsible, using less plastic and more recyclable material. ReefRoids is backed by science and uses 100% ocean-sourced ingredients. No filler, no OGM, no gimmick. Polyp Lab, straight results. The best choice for your marine collection. See the ReefRoids difference for yourself. And now on with the show. So Doug, man, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be on.
So this is the first recorded version I'm doing of the Rapping with Reef Bum show here, and I appreciate you being a guest. Doug, can you just give a brief overview to people out there that might not know you? You know, how you kind of got started in the hobby, your reef keeping journey, so to speak.
Okay. I started as a hobbyist in 1987, which was 3 years after Claude at Fauna started. So I've been around for a little while. I followed you actually in the 90s.
Now you're dating yourself.
Admiring your tanks for many years. I was very aspirational looking at your Acropora back then.
Let me make a point here. I was not keeping those reef tanks like the way I'm keeping my reef tanks today. It was very, very, very simple. I barely, measured anything. I think it was calcium alkalinity, nitrate, and that was kind of like it. I barely looked at my phosphate levels. Maybe I was testing magnesium, temperature and salinity, and that was about it. It was a different time back then.
Certainly was.
Yeah.
Certainly was. But I started with stony corals in the early 90s, and it just gripped me. I was fascinated with it. I've kind of got a brain that works well with systems. I like to understand systems, and I found this as a system, a great puzzle to try and figure out. So I've always been tinkering, if you like, with my understanding of how this system works, understanding the chemistry, the biology, the physics of it. I was pretty good in the 90s, and I said to myself that one day I would have a coral farm. I then pursued a career in software, gave that up about 10 years ago. And I was in a fortunate position where I could start a coral farm. I spent a year planning it, and then Frag Farm was born. And since then, really been, trying to learn how to run a commercial coral farm, which is not easy. But the learning experience in the last 10 years has been incredible. Like you, I'm kind of old school. I started really with back in the old days with actually it's very pertinent to the conversation we're going to have, but back in the old days I used to use a pot of Tropic Marin bicarbonate buffer, and I used to have that by the tank, and I used to take a scoop of that and put a scoop of that in for the day, and I used to watch my Acropora just flourish, you know, the colors. It was under 150 watt metal halides, BLV bulbs, and I used to watch these corals just flourish when you put this spoon of bicarb in. I mean, that's back in the early 90s. And then, you know, you transition to calcium reactors and kalkwasser and refugia. And, you know, so I've tried pretty much everything out there. When I started my farm, it was all big calcium reactors and kalk. And
how did you make that decision in terms of, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, you were on your, you know, like a Reef Central and what have you, and checking out other tanks and what have you. But was there like a mentor of yours or somebody that you really followed closely that gave you more direction in terms of how to start the coral farm?
Oh, it was all you guys in the States were very much instrumental in my thinking. You know, you, Mike Paletta, Dana Riddle, I think has come up with some great stuff over the years. You know, so it's really the old reefers, looking at the old reefers, was really an inspiration to me. And then I think I maybe have a little more of a scientific bent. So I kind of went more into the scientific side of it, looking at some of the research into how things work. So it's gone kind of beyond hobbyist level when I became a pro, a professional coral grower. And so I'm really focused more now on the scientific research into where things are going, and that's how it got into ICP and all that kind of stuff. But what I will say is, you know, I've been through that journey of all of the different techniques, all of the different methods. I've done all the stuff we used to do in the old days. I would say that the old bicarbonate days with the spoon were my best tanks by far. So, and I've tried all the dosing methods and, well, most of the dosing methods. I've tried the carbonates, I've tried the hydroxides, I've tried all of that stuff, and still nothing surpasses that bicarbonate, those bicarbonate tanks I had. And that's kind of what led me to, you know, it's always stuck in the back of my mind, this bicarbonate dosing has always produced good tanks, you know. And then in the farm, you know, when you start a commercial coral farm, it works out great at first, and then you start hitting the problems. And one of the things that I, you know, you could call it greed, I suppose, which is you're always trying to eke out a little bit more growth out of these corals. You're trying to push the boundaries. And then you start pushing kalk and you get pH controllers involved, and you try and control the kalk overnight, and you're trying to stabilize the pH, and you're trying to push things that little bit more. Let's get that pH to 8.4, 8.5, 8.6. That was my thinking back then. And it works for a while, and then it doesn't. So that was my early experience with the farm, is that it worked really great. And then it didn't.
What happened?
What happened is only something I've been pursuing the answer to that for a long, long time. Okay. And it's, I think, something that goes on a lot more than people recognize or let on. Okay. That there are, I speak to people every day, both sides of the Atlantic, who experience these problems. So, you know, and it was actually a conversation when I first got introduced to Claude. That was the first conversation I had with him. And he said, yeah, I've had exactly the same. You know, you go down that path, you're trying to control the pH, you're trying to use high pH solutions. And then 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, 24 months, something like that, around the 18 months mark, you start to get problems. You can no longer maintain the the pH. Corals start to not thrive in the same way they used to. And those are issues that I dealt with. And that's been fundamental, really, to my journey at Frag Farm is coming up with all the stuff that I've been doing with fauna. You know, it was based on how do we find solutions to these kinds of problems in reefing. So that's kind of my journey in a nutshell. I mean, you know, I guess back then when we were having those problems, I was pushed more towards, you know, you naturally go towards ICP. I was a skeptic with ICP at the beginning. I then discovered, actually through Adam, who works with me at the farm, he's my master fragger, and he said, why don't you look into fauna? Fauna ICP and fauna dosing. And that, at the time we were doing calc and calcium reactor, which by the way is a fine system, you know, as long as you don't push the calc side of it too hard, it works just fine.
The issues that you say, and we'll talk about it later, essentially if you're leaning on calc wasser too much, if you're not using a calcium reactor, or if you're going too heavy-handed with a calc wasser, that's what you're talking about in terms of the issues that could happen long term. Okay.
Yeah. And then we eventually took the calcium reactors out, and then we were dosing carbonates with the calc, and that is a disaster. That is a disaster long term. And we can talk about that as well. But all of these problems that, you know, it led to me looking into what are the, you know, we needed to change. And so we started to look around and look at the different solutions that are out there. And it led to me having a look at fauna, where, you know, Adam, my co-worker here, he said, have a look at fauna, see what you think of this. And I started to look into it, and everything that fauna were talking about resonated with me. Okay, I could see the thought process in how the products have been formulated, how they've got the understanding of how the systems work inside a reef tank. So, like I said before, it's, you know, I've got a brain that works in systems. To me, reefing is like a big jigsaw puzzle. Okay, but you don't know what the final picture looks like, and you haven't got all the pieces. And then each of these pieces all interact with each other. Okay, so in terms of Fauna Marine is a company that has the best understanding of that puzzle. Okay, of all of the companies out there, as far as I'm concerned, and it all stems from the fact that they're coral farmers, and they've got an ICP lab. And they produce products based on the knowledge of the two.
Right. They're one of the, if not the only ICP testing company out there that has a coral farm.
Exactly. And I have a coral farm. So when I finally talked to Claude, we talked about all of these issues that I had in my farm at the very beginning. And he said that he'd found the exact same problems. You know, that it works great for a while until it doesn't. And that's why he formulated Fauna Balling Light. And then I moved over to Balling Light, and I've worked with Fauna ICP ever since. And oh my goodness, what a difference. And it was based on that plus past experience that we ended up developing the Bolus method together.
Just for those that might not be in the know on Balling Light and Bolus, can you just give a quick summation of what the basics are for that?
Sure. So Balling Light is a formulation of very pure dosing salts. You've got calcium, alkalinity, and magnesium. The key to it is the purity, okay? The alkalinity is not soda ash. It's a baking soda. It's a sodium bicarbonate based, 100%, as opposed to most of the other systems, which are sodium carbonate based. Along with Balling Light, you get three bottles of traces, two of which go in the calcium. So that's all your metals. And you've got your halogens that go into the alkalinity. It comes as a powder and you mix it. So it's very economic. You know, it's a very economic product. It's cheaper than most. But the key is in the purity of the salts plus what's in those traces. Okay, and there's some very magic things in there, which obviously are a secret source for Claude, but you know, there's some very, very clever stuff which is based on decades of knowledge. I mean, Claude's got 40 years of coral keeping experience. And so there's some things in there that that just make these corals just shine. So it's a three-part system, but it's not like the other three-part systems that are out there. It's something very special about it. All you have to do is look at the Fauna Facebook page and look at the tanks that are running Balling Light, and you can see the difference. I mean, I think the success rate with that product is higher than most, and the long-term loyalty is higher as well.
What about other products out there in the marketplace? You know, Bionic makes the two-part ESV, you know, and those have trace elements in the two different parts. What kind of differences would you say, if you're familiar with the other products out there, would the Fauna Marine Balling Light, what kind of differences would you see there versus other products currently out in the marketplace? Why is the Balling Light and the bolus method a unique thing that you know, you guys have developed there with Claude?
Well, the balling light and the bolus method, you're going to take as two separate entities, if you like. The balling light is a formulation where the trace elements have been, you know, put together based on Claude's experience of how a coral farm uses those trace elements. Okay, and there's certain things that will stimulate corals that are in that balling trace. And it's an old formula that's proven, and it really, really works. The other formulations out there, unless you've got a coral farm, unless you've got a very sophisticated ICP lab, which Claude has, you're not going to be able to formulate those trace elements in the same way. There are recipes, if you like, out there in the scientific community that tell you the academic perspective of you need this amount of trace for this amount of alkalinity and this formulation of trace that goes with this amount of calcium. But these are theoretical. Claude has looked at the practical usage of those trace elements in a coral farm. Okay, so there is a fundamental difference between his product and other products out there. I'm not saying that others haven't done their own research that's valid. Of course they have. But the balling light traces are very well proven, and you can see it in the tanks that run it, particularly in Germany.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just saying, so when we came up with the bolus method, and we probably need to talk about how that came about, but the bolus method also utilizes some of the strengths of that trace formulation to our advantage. In particular, the way the halogens have been formulated in the alkalinity. That's why we put the alkalinity into the system all at once. And then we ramp up the lights. And there's some very good reasons that link back to the traces for why we've come up with that as part of the method.
So the one thing that I think needs to be made clear is you guys do not recommend using traces from other companies with the balling salts, correct?
Correct.
And the reason why is?
Because the formulation of the fauna traces are correct to go with that salt mix.
Could you, in theory, just lean on ICP testing if you're using traces from another company, and then you know, course correct along the way, or is it just you're kind of at a disadvantage by doing that?
I mean, you could, but the thing is, you're looking at traces. You're looking at, when we look at trace elements, we're talking about elements that you can measure on an ICP. There are other things in that balling trace that you cannot measure in an ICP. I can't say more than that.
Gotcha. All right, man. I think we want to dive deeper into all the bolus and a whole bunch of other stuff. But let's circle back, because I think you mentioned ICP consultant, and you know, you've been an ICP consultant for Fauna Marine for a couple of years now. I've been an ICP consultant for a few months. You've been at it a lot longer than I have been. You know, what kind of advantages does that bring for somebody out there that's submitting a Fauna Marine ICP test? You know, you got the option to select an advisor in your country, and I guess you could select an advisor in any country, as long as it's the same language. Then that's probably the key in terms of selecting somebody that you can communicate with. But you know, again, there people might not be familiar with that in terms of this advisor role that comes with the Fauna Marine. How did you get into that, and what's that all about?
Well, I started with, using the Fauna ICP in my farm. That was, you know, we were trying to diagnose issues, and we were trying to get, trying to figure out why things weren't working quite, according to the way we wanted them to work. So, you know, I started to get quite familiar with those, with the ICPs, and the way, again, my brain works is as a system. I got fascinated in understanding the interrelationships between all of these components on the ICP. When you weekly ICP, I mean, we were weekly ICPing four systems. And so we started to really understand how things get consumed and why they get consumed. And it just gave me a very good perspective on how the ICP works. Starting to work with Claude, I mean, my God, that man's just such a treasure trove of information. And so I started to learn at an accelerated rate. I can tell you every year that I've worked with Claude, I've learned more in 1 year than I did the 30 years previous. Right? It's just an exponential process of where we're at a stage now where we just bounce things off each other, and we're testing different things out. And hopefully I'm teaching him a couple of things as well. Maybe not, you know, mainly the information's coming from him still, but the amount of information that is there from his lab is just unbelievable.
Well, you're another data point in terms of, you know, you have a coral farm, and so you have observations based on, what's going on. So that is another data point in terms of on top of coral, the coral fauna marine.
Yeah, I can tell you, for example, I've got two systems, one which may have a low copper reading, one which has a high copper reading. I can tell you the difference between those two corals, you know, between those two systems, how the corals interact. You know, I may have the same lighting and the same water effectively, but one has low copper and one has high copper. And I know the difference. So you start to see signs where you can start to read the corals. And so that gives a level of knowledge, if you like, that goes above and beyond theory. You know, it's really about the practice. And, it came to it where Claude said to me that, you know, he's got this ICP consulting program. You know, you should really think about joining in and helping some other people. And I did. And I've enjoyed every second of it, really. I've so far consulted on, it's got to be getting close to 2,200 ICPs now. It's got to a stage where I get quite a lot sent to me. And so we've had to start charging a little bit for my analysis. But, I like to think I've saved, you know, possibly hundreds of tanks from total wipeout, you know, where we've found certain things, and there's certain tricks and techniques that we've picked up over the years, or that Claude's taught me. So that's really the ICP consulting, I think, is, you know, trying to just raise standards in the hobby and make people aware really of the chemistry.
So you, you're consulting for the UK as well as the US. Have you seen any kind of commonalities, any patterns in the UK itself versus the US, or is there some common things you're seeing across the two countries?
There's a big difference.
Big difference.
Massive difference.
Massive.
Yeah. So in the UK, we tend to have more systems. Like Triton or...
You cut out a little bit there, Doug. You were saying you've got more ICP testing?
A little bit here.
Oh, yeah. You're coming back.
Yeah, my back. Yep. Yeah, so the differences are in the UK, they tend to use more dosed three-part systems with integrated trace. So that's not to say you can't go wrong with that. You can really go wrong with that. But in the US, there tends to be less trace management, if you like. It's more based on this notion that you can keep a tank with water changes and a lot of calc dosing and that kind of stuff. So the difference in the UK and the US has very poor salinity generally. You find very low salinity generally. And that's, I think I put that down to calc. You're trying to maintain the pH and you don't realize that when you start dosing a lot of calc, it's like trying to fly a plane on a single gauge, right? That you need several gauges to fly that plane. So you might know your altitude, but you don't know your speed or your fuel reserves.
So you're saying people are overdoing it with a Cogwasser in the U.S. So they're and Cogwasser dosing is utilizing RODI water, and you're saturating a Cogwasser, and so that's where you're getting the lower salinity.
Correct. Yeah. So there's I would say that more than 50% of the U.S. ICPs have got a low salinity.
What are some signs for corals of low salinity? What can happen?
Well, you get the signs of things like low calcium. So you can get a browning out of the corals. You can get metabolic issues. So, sometimes you can get a tissue loss at the base of acros, for example. It could be anything really, but salinity is the number one parameter that you need to chase because it determines the concentration of every other element in your water. Mm-hmm. So that's number one that I see in the US. The second is phosphate, man. Oh, you boys love to feed.
That's not my problem. My problem's the opposite. I got perpetually low phosphates.
The number of ICPs I've seen come back with 3 or 4 ppm of phosphate. Oh, man, that's really bad. Really, really bad. So phosphate is a biggie. And I try my best to try and explain to people that you cannot have phosphate that high because basically everything that calcifies absorbs phosphate. So your corals are absorbing that phosphate into the skeleton. It not only is it messing up your calcification, so it makes the corals grow in weird ways, but it eventually what happens is you try and reduce the phosphates in your water, and that phosphate leaches back out again, and it causes all manner of problems for the corals.
I think a lot of people will just lean on GFO, which is a great way to remove phosphates, but the problem is it also removes other valuable trace elements. So you kind of get into a wicked bad pattern.
The other one is lanthanum.
Yeah.
That's a big problem, right? So lanthanum, you can go crazy because it's instant. It's effective. It's very instant. You put lanthanum in, whoosh, your phosphate is suddenly into that smoky, precipitation that's in the water. The problem with doing that is you're disturbing the equilibrium. So the coral has to equilibrate with the phosphate in the coral has to equilibrate with what's in the water. So you suddenly remove it from the water, all this phosphate has to come out of the coral, and of course it goes straight into the tissue of the coral, and that completely jiggers the chemistry inside the coral. So that's another biggie. What else do we see in the US?
I see a lot of low fluoride.
Low fluoride would be probably my next one. Yeah. Yeah. So low fluoride is typically because the dosing systems that you're using maybe aren't focused on fluoride, or that the importance of fluoride isn't recognized. It, you know, to put things in perspective, my top three parameters, salinity is definitely number one. Number two is calcium. Another thing I see in the US is calcium way too high. Even the advice that's given out on YouTube by some of the big players, way too high, way too high. You cannot run a tank with 500 calcium.
Yeah, you know, I that is an issue that I run into. I push calcium into the the low 400s, and you know, it's something that is a detriment in terms of doing the calcium reactor with the Kalkwasser, is that you don't have the ability to kind of control that calcium, and the reason why the elevated calcium is an issue is precipitation, correct? That's correct. After a certain level, like 440 calcium level, you could potentially start getting the precipitation going in the tanks. And I don't know, why don't you explain that, Doug, in terms of what happens if you get too high over the calcium?
Yeah, so salt water is innately unstable. Okay, people don't recognize this, but things fall out of solution all the time. And so there's a limit to how much you can have in solution. So if you put too much calcium into your water, you know, around the 440 mark in typical on average parameters is enough to start causing an excess of calcium where it starts to form calcium carbonate. And that can be in the form of aragonite or calcite. Now, a great sign, the things that will influence that will be, to some extent, temperature, pressure, and organics. So how many people have pulled their heater out of the sump to find it coated in calcium carbonate deposits, right? So the first place you're going to see it is where there's heat. So that is precipitation. You'll also see it on pumps because there's pressure. Okay, and the pressure increases the rate of precipitation. But generally speaking, 440 is a limit where if you've got relatively low nutrients, that's the limit I would be going to. If you have higher nutrients, I'd even go lower than that. 400 is around the number you want, because you increase the amount of organics, you increase the amount of precipitation. Now, that precipitation occurs in three places, three ways, if you like. First is the production of aragonite, which you tend to see on the air-water interface. So around the rim of your aquarium, you'll get that sort of white calcium scum, if you like, around the edge. That's the first telltale sign. It's where the air and the water meet that you're going to get formation of aragonite. The second precipitation is that brown, gray, dusty detritus that builds up.
That's what I'm getting on the bottom one of my tanks. Yeah.
Right. So this is a mixture of organics, fish waste, and calcium carbonate of aragonite. Okay. And when that precipitation forms, it grabs fluoride, it grabs organics, nutrients, trace metals, all sorts of things. It's grabbing into that, and it creates what Claude calls a depot. Okay, and that depot is storing all this stuff up. And if you don't clean that detritus out, you can have certain events where it all leaches back out again all at once. And that's one of the major reasons for tank crashes. It's primarily one of the reasons for old tank syndrome as well.
Is it more prone to happen in a tank with a sand bed versus a beer bottom tank?
Yeah, if you don't clean the organics out, if you don't clean the waste, because the organics act as a nucleation site for the precipitation. So it's like a magnet for that precipitation to latch onto. So where you get organics and precipitation together is a deadly combination. There's a third method of form of precipitation that is going onto surfaces, onto your rock work, onto media, biomedia, effectively onto egg crate or glass or whatever. And that's a much harder form That's a nucleated precipitation which can form apatites. It's a calcium phosphate which binds things like bromide, fluoride, hydroxide ions, chloride, and so on. And that forms a very hard, I mean, it'll be a very thin layer of precipitation that goes over your surfaces. How many times have you seen where people struggle to get rid of phosphate? So you come in and you put in GFO. A number of times this has happened. People have bought some GFO from me and said, I tried this, it's rubbish, it doesn't work. Or lanthanum. I tried this lanthanum, it doesn't work. Because it reduces my phosphate for one day and then it all comes back again. Well, why does that happen? Happens because the phosphate is bound to the surfaces. And what happens is you're removing it from the water column and it's leaching back out from the surfaces back into the water column to find an equilibrium. So that form of precipitation onto surfaces is something that we as reefers are only really starting to understand in depth. And it's actually part of our understanding of the bolus method, which we'll get to, I guess, in a moment. So those are the forms of precipitation. The more you use carbonates, the more you use hydroxides, the more you're creating that precipitation. And that's the controversial part of when you talk to me is, you know, when you use bicarbonates, we've shown that there is less precipitation happening in your tank, which means actually you've got a lot less. You've got a greater stability in your elements because there's less being bound into things, into the surfaces.
Yeah, you know, it's and over time, you're saying that this is what could potentially lead to old tank syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've seen it. I mean, we've seen it. Claude's seen it multiple times. I've seen it multiple times. You start pushing the envelope too hard with carbonates and calc, you're going to end up with these precipitations forming on your rockwork. And it doesn't take much for a trigger point where all of that stuff comes back. So this could be a power cut. It could be you've run out of dosing solution and you didn't notice and your pH goes down. A telltale sign actually is if your system is relying on dosing to maintain the pH, then you've got a problem. That's the start of the problem. And you see it particularly with calc systems. I've got five ICP clients at the moment that have this problem, four of them in the US. Okay. This is where you rely 100% on calc to try and keep your pH up. And then what happens is you need ever increasing amounts of calc to try and maintain that pH to the point we're just creating more and more precipitation. You end up in a doom loop. And then all that happens is something breaks and then the pH cannot be maintained anymore. Now, we are pretty sure that this is down to bacteria, biofilms, growing on this precipitation on the rockwork. And the more bacteria that grows, it grows because it's everything it needs in that precipitation. It's got nutrients, organics, it's got trace elements. You know, it's got everything it needs to be able to grow. And as you know, when you put a load of bacteria into a system, it reduces the pH. So it's constantly these biofilms are constantly suppressing the pH. The more biofilms that you grow on these surfaces, the more it's going to affect the buffer system that is trying to regulate your pH.
All right, a couple of questions here. You mentioned bacteria. But I want to ask, I'm going to get to that, but I also want to ask a question, another question about kalkwasser. There's a very devoted bunch that, you know, use a kalk slurry. So that's a very concentrated solution of kalkwasser, and it's a space-saving type of thing where you could have a kind of like kalkwasser on steroids, where you just have mm-hmm. a very, very high concentration of a dosing. What is the propensity of you know, folks that, in your opinion, that use the slurry in terms of hitting that wall, that death loop, versus just the standard use of Cogwalzer?
You're massively increasing it. I mean, massively. So you're effectively inducing precipitation in a massive way, because the water cannot process large amounts of calcium carbonate production in the system. Effectively, when you put a hydroxide into the water, it's stripping CO2. Okay, it's turning the CO2, it's reacting with the CO2 to form a calcium carbonate. And the calcium carbonate is a limited amount of calcium carbonate that can be in seawater. Once you hit the limit, it has to fall out it has to precipitate out. Okay, and then what it will do is find a surface to precipitate on. If it can find a surface with organics, it will precipitate even harder. So you're creating effectively an uncontrolled precipitation event by using a slurry in that way. Now, the argument is, oh, yeah, but you don't see it. No, you won't see it necessarily, because it's a thin layer that's forming right the way across. If it's forming as apatites, it's a very hard substance. Apatite is a gemstone. You know, it's not the hardness of diamond, but it's a very dense, thick formation of calcium phosphate.
Gotcha. All right, so bacteria. You mentioned bacteria in terms of dosing bacteria and how that potentially can accentuate the problem in terms of the precipitate and precipitation and absorbing things. Are you basically saying that dosing bacteria to an established reef tank is not a good thing, that can lead to the long-term issues, or is there some use cases in your opinion for bacteria dosing to an established reef tank?
No, I wasn't actually saying about dosing bacteria. These are bacteria that are just developing naturally in your aquarium. So where you're getting a nucleated surface, you're going to get bacteria growing where there's precipitation.
Right.
Dosing bacteria, my views are slightly different. So bacteria, you should be thought of as a tool. What is that tool? Well, typically the tool is there as a cleanup. So certain bacteria can be very useful for addressing certain nutrient issues, for example.
Yep.
So there'd be products to use there. You could also use, if you have issues with nitrification, that can help. That can help enormously as well. But generally, I don't dose bacteria. I don't really see the need in an established reef tank to dose it. Let me ask you a question. What do you think the rate of reproduction of bacteria is in a reef tank?
I have no friggin' idea. I mean, it's fast. I think it's fast. So I guess your point is that there's already a lot of bacteria reproducing in the reef tank, so why add more? I guess the question would be to add a diversity of bacteria strains. Can that be beneficial?
Yeah, by putting a piece of live rock in, certainly. Put a new piece of live rock, you're going to introduce diversity. Put a new coral in that's come in, from that's been relatively newly imported. Yeah, you're going to add bacteria that way. If you've got the right conditions for bacteria to grow, that bacteria is reproducing at a rate of 100% every 20 minutes. And it's only constrained by nutrients and organics or whatever it needs to reproduce. As soon as it gets limited, then it kind of stops growing. So that's my view on bacteria. I mean, there's a lot more in your tank than you think there is. It's basically just a glass box of bacteria, viruses, fungus, and
there's a lot of stuff in there. Good and
that's
bad.
All reproducing. Yeah. So I would question, if you're dosing bacteria, why are you dosing that bacteria? Is there a specific reason why you're doing it?
A lot of times,
and there are valid.
I was going to say, a lot of times I hear, sorry to cut you off. So a lot of times I hear that, you know, corals consume bacteria. So that's a benefit to corals is that those bacteria.
And they do. Yeah. They do. One of the things you need to look after are those biofilms I was talking about, because those biofilms typically are taking our organic traces that we're dosing and converting them to organic forms of trace elements. Those films slough off, and the corals are eating that slime that those films are giving off. And that's a very large part of their trace input is from that. So, and those films are bacteria. They're on the surfaces. It's just you don't want that precipitation to allow those bacteria populations to run away and become enormous. Because then they become a burden on the buffer system.
What about carbon dosing? So dosing a carbon source to help amplify your population of bacteria in the tank. You know, a lot of folks, well, I don't know about a lot of folks, but there's folks out there now, some well-known reefers that are doing ammonia dosing, and some of them are carbon dosing along with that.
Yeah, 100%. I think carbon dosing is, again, a tool that should be used correctly. There's two ways. One is obviously it's very effective at reducing nutrients, and it's going to grow a whole ton of bacteria that's going to help you reduce your nitrate and phosphate 100%. I mean, I've used it very effectively in the farm. Old tanks tend to get carbon deficient as well. So, sorry, I've got a dog here that's moaning at me. He's going to want to go out in a minute. But old tanks tend to get carbon deficient as well. So having a carbon source there permanently can be very useful. Certainly, if you're running a low nutrient system, having a carbon source is very important.
Do you want to let the dog out? Their dog?
I'm going to let the dog out. Hang on a sec.
Do you need to let the dog back in soon?
Nah, he can stay out. Right. He can stay out. He probably won't be back for another half an hour. So.
All right. So let's talk about some more specific stuff with bolus. Mm. What so there's a lot of information out there about bolus. There might be some I think there was some misconceptions, most likely, but how was the bolus method developed? I mean, I know you said that you know, you had been kind of kicking the tires and this sort of thing for a long time, and both you and Claude came to kind of some similar conclusions, but can you give us a little bit more detail in terms of how it was developed?
It came about from a conversation that we had about the old ways of reefing. And, you know, we came to the conclusion that actually reef tanks are harder to run these days than they were in the old days. And I don't know what your views are on that.
Yes, I agree.
You agree?
I agree. Well, it's something where I think there's so much out there. There's a lot more information out there today. There's many more different ways, I believe, to run a reef tank. There's many more different things to add to a reef tank.
Yeah.
There's just more information. I see P testing, and you kind of get. I mean, at least I do. I've been getting drawn in at times, and on certain things, and experimented, and right. And so that complicates things.
Right. So, you know, when you've got. A certain number of tens of thousands of hours of dealing with a certain subject, you get pretty expert in it. I think it was Malcolm Gladwell, the author, that came up with that concept. But I think when you get to the sort of 20,000 to 25,000 hours of practicing something, you get pretty good at it, right? So Claude and I were both in that category where we thought, well, actually, what is it with those old systems that really worked? Why? why is systems that we have don't give you the same feeling when the corals, you know, the corals aren't quite as responsive to, you know, in the way they used to be. Or there was another factor, which was we never used to have problems with tanks crashing and things like that years ago in the same way that we do now.
Yeah, I think the issues that I always had run into years ago was pests. So it was activating flatworms and red bugs and blah blah blah. Right. You know, you didn't really know you had them, and then it's just kind of like there was this thing like, oh,
we've got some interesting research on that as well. I mean, Claude's the man to speak to about acroporating flatworm. But there's some interesting stuff that he's come up with recently. But back to the bolus conversation. So where it came about was, you know, we were laughing at the idea that we used to put spoons of bicarb into our systems, and they actually looked really good, you know. And we said, why was that? Why did that work so well? Why did the corals respond to it so well? Because it's kind of the opposite of the way we've been trained to think. So we started to research it. And, you know, because we both got farms, we started working on the principle of dose, all the alkalinity all at once, and the results were remarkable. What we found was incredibly stable systems. We found that, you know, back 25 years ago we didn't have all the tools that we've got now, like KH directors and
when you say
controllers and so on.
You say incredibly stable systems, what kind of parameters are you talking about?
Alkalinity. I tell you that the real one that I'm interested in is having trace stability. Mm. So fluoride, metals, copper, nickel, vanadium, zinc, molybdenum, those I want stable.
Dynamic elements.
The dynamic elements. I want my iodine to be in the right place. I don't want my calcium to be fluctuating. Everyone talks about flat alkalinity. They're missing the trick here. Okay. But actually bolus gives you flat alkalinity, that which defies all logic. You're dosing all your alkalinity in one go at the beginning of the day, and it gives you completely flat alkalinity, better than any machine could give you. Okay. And people don't believe this. But go and look at the materials we've put out there. I've done a video on the Frag Farm YouTube page that gives you all the graphs and stats about, you know, how the bolus is performing in the farm.
And that alkalinity is essentially, so what you're saying is you're doing the bolus, which is the bulk dump of the alkalinity right before the lights go on. I guess the alkalinity spikes a little bit after that, but then it pretty much stays level.
It goes up. Yeah. So, I mean, this is the first criticism, if you like, of the bolus system is, oh, I'm not going to do that because I don't want my alk to spike. You've had your brain infected. If you did this with carbonates, I would 100% agree with you. You're going to wipe the tank out because you're going to create a mass precipitation event, and all your calcium and all your traces are going to fall out of solution. It'll go like milk. If you do it with bicarbonate, it doesn't. And if you do it with bicarbonate, something really magical happens. I can dose 2 dkh of alkalinity into a system in one go. I could literally take a beaker of alkalinity solution, pour it into the system, and I'll only get 0.4 dkh increase. Explain that. Because we understand why this happens now. We didn't completely at first, but we can explain how this happens. And I'll come to that. But this is one big misconception, is that when you dump a load of bicarbonate into a system, that you're going to get a big alkalinity spike. You won't. By the way, the only caveat here is if you've been dosing high pH solutions like hydroxides or high pH carbonate stuff, and you've got that precipitation on the rock, yes, that can affect it. Where it will show the full 2 dKH that you've dosed because you're not getting the effect that I'm about to describe. Okay, but there's a specific effect that has to occur. But if you've got clean surfaces and you pour it, you put a big bolus of bicarbonate into your system, you will not get a massive alkalinity spike. You'll get a little bit, but then something really magical happens. The alkalinity flattens out, and throughout the day, it's flat, 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 flat. So for 6, 8, 10 hours, you get flat alkalinity.
What happens when the lights go out?
It drops a bit. Not too much. It drops a bit. And it doesn't matter.
And largely and what kind of pH range would you say the typical bolus user is seeing?
8.2 to 8.4. Okay. We get complaints that the pH is going too high. Okay. Now, what dosing system have you seen where that happens? So we've also been told that, oh, on no accounts does bicarb raise the pH. Are you crazy? By the way, you have to follow our instructions very carefully with this. If you don't follow the instructions, if you don't, there's a specific timing that has to be done. The bolus has to go in at least 30 minutes before the lights come on, and the tank needs to be dark. So if you're getting any sunlight into the tank, it won't work. And then you've got a little raise in the lighting, a little increase in the intensity of the lighting at the very beginning. You have a very short ramp up time. So you're literally waking the corals up and giving them a shake before they have their breakfast. Okay, so that's effectively the bolus method. The calcium, the magnesium is just dosed normally throughout the day, on a hourly basis, if you like. But the key thing is the alkalinity is dumped in one go, and it's done 30 minutes before the lights go on. I will stress, by the way, people listening to this will go, oh, that's an interesting idea. I'll try that with my Triton or my whatever it is. Don't do it unless you're using the right stuff. And the right stuff is fauna balling light.
What about the, so it's a three-part system, and you've got traces, right, in each of those three parts?
Yes.
Talk to us about the traces that are getting dosed in that bolus dump with the alkalinity. Why is it okay for that to be, in the bolus dump without, okay, versus, evenly throughout the day?
So you're getting, there's four major things going in the alkalinity. There's fluoride, there's iodine in its various forms. It's bromine, and it's selenium.
So you've got the key halogens in there.
So the key halogens are in there. Mathematically, you're increasing those halogens by a tiny percentage overall in the tank. But having that increase in the halogens does several things. One is halogens are used to protect corals against light. So they're there to protect against ROS, which stands for reactive oxygen species. So when you subject a coral to light, you end up with little oxygen ions zipping around inside, causing damage. The fluoride particularly cancels that out. The second thing is, there's a whole series of effects that happens, but effectively the halogens are there to protect the coral against that intense light that you're going to get. Halogens are also used in photosynthesis. Okay, so having that extra halogen boost enables them to photosynthesize better. One interesting trait that I see in US, mainly US or calc users, on the ICPs, I would say about 80% of the time, it's quite a common feature. When you dose heavy calc, you end up with accumulations of bromine. And the accumulation of bromine is a suggestion that the photosynthesis isn't working as it should.
So is that what's going on with me? Because I do have high bromine levels. You know, I'm using the Kalkwasser and the calcium reactor. I know you've kind of helped me troubleshoot that. And I think I've talked to Claude about that, and I know that I use a lot of nori, and there's a lot of you know, iodine and bromine, I believe, in nori. So I kind of thought that was an instance where that might have been coming through. But that's I don't recall you saying that before in terms of the potentially being due to the cogwalls.
Or... Yeah, so I think where that comes from is obviously photosynthesis, it needs CO2. If you've been dumping a load of calc in overnight, it's stripping CO2 out of the water effectively to produce the carbonate. So there's not enough CO2 left for the corals to be able to photosynthesize correctly at the beginning of the photoperiod. And so if it's not photosynthesizing correctly, it's not utilizing all of the halogens correctly. And bromine is typically only used in photosynthesis in corals. Mm. So that could be why it's accumulating. So I think, and like I say, I see this, it's a very common thing I see on the ICPs, and it's mainly in the US.
Interesting.
Once you get bromine accumulating to about 85 to 90, 95, you start getting real problems with RTN. So it becomes toxic very quickly, as all the halogens, well, fluoride and bromine will get toxic pretty quickly.
A little sidebar here. What are your thoughts in terms of utilizing antibiotics to solve RTN-STN issues? Not a fan.
No.
Not a fan. No. You're more of a fan of correcting the chemistry.
We can't use antibiotics here
right. In
Europe. I mean, we have to find other ways. But if you're using antibiotics, this is a difference maybe in culture as well. Is the American culture tends to be about medicating problems rather than sorting the problems before they occur, right? You've got to ask yourself the question, if you're having to treat with antibiotics, why? That means the coral's not healthy, right? So a coral should be able to defend itself against parasites pretty well. And one of the features of the fauna, that is a new feature of the fauna ICP, is a metric called FSS.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've noticed it.
Yeah.
And it stands for fluoride, strontium, and sulfur. And sulfur has become very prominent in a lot of Claude's research.
I've noticed, by the way, that there's a lot of ICP tests that I see that are low in sulfur and sulfate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Definitely. And it's a recent thing. There seems to be a lot less sulfur in people's tanks in the last 2 years. Now, that could come from lack of water changes. People are maybe water changing less, so you're putting less sulfur in with the water change. It could also be to do with the supply of the chemicals that goes into the additives. Maybe the sulfur is less concentrated in those. I don't know the answer, but there's certainly a trend where there's less sulfur in people's tanks. We're actually finding that higher sulfur is going to lead to more parasitic resistant corals. So I try and run my sulfur levels around 1,000 ppm.
Gotcha.
And it works great. And as long as you keep your sulfur, your strontium, and your fluoride, and the fluoride I insist on keeping above 1.3. As soon as you start getting to about 0.9, 0.8, you're going to start to encounter problems.
I know Claude likes to run, he suggested to me running fluoride 1719.
Yeah. But the thing is, it has to be in relation to the other halogens. So if you're running one high, you've got to run the others high too, really. There's no point running low iodine with high fluoride, because that's kind of felt out of proportion. So back to the antibiotic thing. I mean, if you can, you know, what's the saying? A prevention is worth something to do with a cure. I don't know.
Pound of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Is that what it
That's
is?
That's the one. That's the one I was trying to think of. Little brain fart then. That's really where I'm at. And I think that, you know, you hear all this stuff on YouTube about, oh, yeah, my corals are, subject, there's a pathogenic bacteria that's getting them. Yeah, because they're not resistant to the bacteria. Here's an interesting little snippet, okay? Because we talk about bad bacteria and good bacteria,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
Okay. One of the prominent biofilms that we have on our surfaces that are crucial, they process a lot of stuff, okay, is Vibrio. Vibrio is synonymous with disease, right?
It's, yes.
It's fish disease. But Vibrio is a biofilm, and it's prevalent on surfaces in your tank. As soon as your coral starts to suffer and the tissue starts to thin, the Vibrio thinks it's another surface to colonize. And that's why you get Vibrio on these corals. Okay, so yeah, you'll get a pathogenic bacteria that is going to eat away at the coral as soon as the coral is in a position where it can't defend itself. So this is why that prevention is so important, to make sure those elements are kept within
the
range.
So hitting the tank with antibiotics will eliminate the pathogenic bacteria, but it's not going to solve the inherent problem if you're out of sync with your trace elements.
It does something else. It destroys the biome,
right?
The microbiome of the coral.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're doing is you might solve the problem short term, but you're doing is probably reducing the effectiveness of its coral's recovery long term, because it may not be able to recover that biome in time to be able to defend itself well. It's a pretty hostile environment in a reef, in reef water. So that's my view on antibiotics. I would rather the reefing community focuses on the prevention rather than the cure.
What if you're having an episode? What if you're losing corals, you're getting RTN and STN, and you're suggesting not using antibiotics? What would be your suggestion to people to beat the problem?
Find out why you've got the problem.
Can it be resolved?
Seek help, because I can guarantee you somebody out there with the 20,000 to 25,000 hours of experience will have seen it before. So engage an ICP consultant, hopefully a fauna one, and we should be able to help you to work out what it is.
So in other words, there's some adjustments that can be made in terms of the traces to help resolve that issue.
It may be nothing to do with traces. It may be to do with buildup of organics. It may be you've got a rotten spot in your aquarium that you've not noticed. You've got substrates that are starting to go anaerobic. It could be that you've got hydrogen sulfide being produced somewhere, which is turning to sulfuric acid in the water, and it's destroying your buffer system. It could be anything, but just go to somebody who's got some experience and work out why you're having the problem.
So I interrupted your thought in terms of, or your explanation on FSS, but I want you to get back to that, Doug. Sulfur, so we're talking about sulfur, perpetually low levels of sulfur. What's a way to solve that issue? Is it just changing the salt you're using, doing more water changes?
Dose it. Use Elementals S and just dose the sulfur. Because sulfur is a major element, one of the big surprises that people have is the amount of sulfur you need to dose. For my systems, if I'm 100 ppm short of... By the way, my systems use 20 ppm of sulfur a week.
Yeah.
And to put it in perspective, one of my biggest systems here is to replace 100 ppm of sulfur is 3 kilos dry weight of sulfur powder.
That's so a lot of sulfur.
It's a lot of stuff that you're pouring into the system, and you've got to dose sulfur relatively slowly as well. Because sulfur is part of it has its own buffer system in the water. It's a complicated bit of chemistry that's going on in there. But Yeah, you need to dose the sulfur slowly, but that's the answer, is dose the sulfur.
So getting back to FSS, it is it's a key indicator in terms of being able to protect the corals from parasites like aggravating flatworms as well as pathogenic bacteria.
Yep, definitely. And when you keep those elements higher, you're less susceptible to pests, that's for certain.
Okay. So let's get into, man, the initial feedback you're getting from bolus users. What are you hearing? Happy campers? Summon it.
I would say we've got something like a 96% success rate. Something, it's maybe even higher than that. In Germany, where obviously there's a little bit more hand-holding from Claude, you know, it's a very, very high success rate. We've got people throwing, you know, had persistent perpetual pH issues that have now no longer got pH issues. People who've had to spend a lot of money on CO2 scrubbers, they've now thrown away their CO2 scrubbers. No need for Kalkwasser.
You can't use
Life.
Kalkwasser with this, right?
No,
Yeah.
you don't want to use calc with it. Absolutely, you don't want to use calc with it. But the point is, you don't need calc because you can now regulate your pH as it should. So generally speaking, I would say that people are achieving a good natural reef tank pH range of sort of 8.1 to 8.4, something like
So
that.
no need to run an airline tubing outside to the skimmer intake. Even if you have a very well sealed house, the windows are not open, you don't have some sort of ventilation, you're still gonna have a an elevated pH with bolus.
Yes. I mean, it may not be 100% where I've described it. If you've not got, you know, if obviously if there's a CO2, a lot of CO2 in the room, there's a thing called Henry's Law that's going to equilibrate with the air. The water has to equilibrate with the air. But generally speaking, your pH issues will be improved significantly with bolus.
How high is too high in terms of pH?
I don't like to see above 8.5. 8.45, kind of, that's for me a peak. As soon as you go beyond that, you're not actually increasing growth. You're just creating problems. You're creating more precipitation with high pH, by the way. 8.2 to 8.4 is kind of the perfect sweet spot for coral growth. So, you know, generally speaking, the bolus user is not going below 8.2, 8.1 at night, which is just perfect.
So they're seeing elevated pH, and what are the observations with the corals?
LPS puffier, corals, the Acropora tend to be a bit more defined, the colors a bit more defined, more metallic hues in the coloration. Stronger chromoprotein production, better polyp extension. One downside, which is a nice downside to have, but you get more coral aggression because the corals are growing quicker. You know, they're clearing their path to try and grow because they're in growth mode. So you hit a growth metabolism a lot quicker with the bolus method. Generally speaking, the tank is easier to run. Because you're doing an alkalinity measurement, you've got one dose, there's less risk because you've got less technical componentry. No calcium reactors to block up, there's no calc that you're going to run out of calc, or the stirrer motor fails, or your pH controller goes a bit wobbly. You know, you don't need any of that. You don't need pH monitoring with it, really, because it does it naturally, does it, you know, all by itself to regulate the pH. So yeah, it's an easier method. It works extremely well. We've seen better growth, better color, more stability in the systems. Now, the key is what I wanted to do was really talk about another facet of bolus, the development that we'd never really talked about. We've talked in all our videos and communication so far about pH and alkalinity and maintaining that. There are two really important things I wanted to reveal on this show.
I appreciate the
One,
exclusivity.
Oh, yeah, yeah. One is the major reason, and I've hinted at it before in what I said, is stability of your trace elements. People send ICPs out to try and, you know, you're constantly trying to balance these elements. If you want a nice, stable ICP, Bolus method is the way to do it. As long as you keep your major elements within the correct range, you don't have your calcium too high, you don't have your strontium or potassium too high, you're going to have a beautifully stable ICP where you're not going to be depleted heavily in dynamic elements. You're not going to be depleted in fluoride and so on.
How often does a bolus user have to dose individual traces to try to dial in something that might not be dialed in with the three-part dosing?
My systems, I can give you my personal experience, is hardly anything. So we do weekly ICPs. I'll be lucky if every fourth ICP, I'm dosing a tiny little bit of zinc or a little bit of copper. Hardly anything. And it's all perfectly within range and in ratio. That's the key. When you're dosing other systems that create precipitation, what you've got to understand is that precipitation is dragging out fluoride. It's dragging out copper and nickel and zinc and vanadium. And it's depositing it into those precipitants, those precipitations. So you're never going to get a straight, clean ICP as long as you're creating precipitation. Okay, now, all you have to do is, if you want confirmation, is to look at any research paper that talks about sediments in oceans. These guys who are dealing with that side of aquatic chemistry and geology, the geochemists, know full well that elements get deposited onto surfaces in the sea. Okay. And the way you can induce that is by using carbonates and hydroxides. So the clue is there, right? Yeah. In the science. Now, the big reveal is really our understanding of how bolus works. How do we get from a single big dose, let's say of 2 DKH, but it only adds 0.4? Or less sometimes, and it creates this flat alkalinity. How is that possible? And it took us a long time to find out. The answer lies in a very special property of bicarbonate, of sodium bicarbonate. When you add it to seawater, even though it's a liquid, it doesn't dissolve. It stays in a form in the water, and it's called a dense layer precursor phase. Okay, a DLP.
DLP.
And this
short.
this science is so new. The papers were really only written about this year. Okay, but actually, inadvertently, we were doing this 30 years ago, and we were creating these amazingly stable systems by putting scoops of bicarb into the system, not knowing at all what was happening with the chemistry.
Yeah.
But now, because we've got all these tools, we can see the effect of what it does. So the bicarbonate, what it does is it creates like a microcrystal. You can't see it, but it's adhering to a surface. And that surface has to be relatively clear of that bacteria that we were talking about, that biofilm. And what it does is, as the alkalinity is used, it cools off on those crystals. Okay, and there's a very special piece of chemistry, which is it was known as a kinetic constraint of carbon dioxide. So basically, the this chemistry, but effectively it means that it takes these it takes from these little bicarbonate crystals, in preference to bringing in carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And that's why the pH is maintained with the bolus system. That's why we have nearly 3,000 people enjoying good pH in their tanks that they've never had before. Okay. So there's no way you can say it doesn't work because we've got the proof in the users. But this is what they're experiencing. When you dose the alkalinity, it's creating this dense this dense liquid precursor phase onto the surfaces, and it cools off on that over the day. And I don't think we've ever explained that before. But this is the magic of how it works. You cannot do it with carbonate. It doesn't work with carbonate. It only works with sodium bicarbonate. There are some features of the balling traces. So I want to emphasize, when we talk about balling traces, they're not just trace elements in there. There's other things. There's a component in there that I believe helps with that dense liquid precursor phase.
And those are being held close to the vest there?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, that's going to be a proprietary piece of IP. Yeah. And I don't even know what those are. Okay,
but you're not even in the know on that.
I Claude's going to keep some secrets, you know. but this is I mean, we were shocked at really how well this worked. And when we first got into it, I've been running Bolus on my systems now for nearly 4 years. And I can tell you the difference it's made to the stability in my ICPs is unreal. For me now, just looking at an ICP is like there's nothing to do, you know.
That's a nice
problem to have.
That's a nice problem to have. So you mentioned 94% of the people have given you positive feedback. What about the 6%? What kind of negative feedback are you getting from the 6%?
Okay, so as I stated before, anybody who has been running high pH solutions in their system are going to have these precipitations on their surfaces. It will not work if there is a large amount of organic activity on those surfaces. If there's an intense amount of biofilm production due to precipitation, you will not get these crystals forming. So when you put the 2 dKH in that your tank requires over 24 hours, you will see a 2 dKH spike in your alkalinity. Okay. Not that it's going to hurt anything, but what you have to do is then you're not going to get the pH increases that we're talking about. What you have to do is persevere. You have to persevere until those precipitations wear out. So the bacteria effectively chews through all of that precipitation, and then you're back to the sort of back to the bare rock, back to the basic normal biofilms. Then it will start to work. That process can take between 2 and 9 weeks. If you've really got a bad system that you've been calcing heavily for years and running your calcium at 550, it may never work. You may have to change the rock.
So it's basically a natural chemical thing that will occur in the tank when you decide to make that transition between using calcium reactor Kogwasser or just Kogwasser solely to bowlers. There's nothing you can do to help expedite it or kind of clear the decks.
Not really, other than changing the rock. That's really the only thing you can do. So those who've really tried it and went, no, it didn't work for me. My pH, I'm too scared. My pH is too low. Well, yeah, it will be for a while, but some of those people can't deal with that. You've got to understand, when you've been dosing a tank heavily on calc for years, the tank gets addicted, right? And you stop dosing and just watch the pH plummet. So it's the opposite of bolus. In bolus, we're dosing it once and it's maintaining its beautiful, lovely, shiny pH, okay, throughout the day. And it doesn't need any interference from you. It just does it. It just deals with it. With a calc-based system, you have to be constantly dosing it for it to work.
So, you know, Bolus has created a bit of a lightning rod of criticism from some folks that are very, have very strong opinions about certain things that Bolus claims. What would you say are some of those false claims out there about Bolus that, need to be addressed or false claims that, you would like to debunk?
Okay. First is that bicarbonate doesn't raise pH. Go and ask the 3,000 people already running Bolus if it doesn't. Okay. I've produced videos on this that shows the dosing in my farm, and with all the lights off, and you can see the pH going up on a screen, okay, as the bicarb is dosed. I've got another one coming out soon that shows it even better. So bicarb, if you know the chemistry in an aquatic environment, will raise the pH quite substantially as long as you dose it in the right way at the right time. And so try it. That's the easiest way. Try it. Take a spoon of boiling light alkalinity powder and put it in your tank and watch the pH go up. It's very simple. And then tell me, there's some wonderful people out there who could tell you all the theories. They've never tried it. They've never tried what we're describing. They're just saying, they're just reciting stuff, theoretical stuff out of textbooks that they've learned, right? But they're not trying it. You think we haven't tried this? We've spent years working on this. You know, we our core group of people in the UK and in Germany have all tried this. We've had pretty much 100% success rate with advanced reefers on this. You know, and these guys are running big Acropora tanks. We had tremendous success with those guys. And that's before we even released it. So it's been tested, and we know what the what the expected results are going to be. So that would be the first criticism. What's the other criticisms? I don't know. What have you heard?
Well, you know, one thing that's in the back of my mind is I used to dose two-part ESV bionic two-part for years and years. I mean, that's kind of what I did when I first got into the hobby. Then I transitioned to Casm reactors and Kalkwasser because it got expensive. The two-part got very expensive because I was running, SPS-dominant systems. There was a high demand for calcium and alkalinity. So I wanted to save some money. I wanted to, Kalkwasser and a Casm reactor, there's not as much of an expense, not much of an investment monthly in terms of, maintaining the key parameters in the tank using that methodology. So I think that's always been a hesitation for me in terms of kind of like going back to the two-part or the three-part dosing system. If you've got a very large tank with a high demand, for calcium and alkalinity.
Okay, this is a great one. I like this question a lot, okay? This is a good one. So, ESV, is that carbonate-based or bicarb-based?
I don't want to say either way because I'm not sure.
Okay. So carbonate's more expensive. I mean, it's more concentrated than bicarbonate, but bicarbonate generally is a cheaper product, okay? If you look at boiling light, it's not expensive. It's one of the cheapest dosing systems out there. Okay. Part of that is because you're not shipping water around the world.
Right.
You're shipping a powder,
right?
It's a doddle. It's easy to make the solutions. It's not difficult at all. I can produce 40 liters of alkalinity out of a 4 kilo tub of alkalinity. 4 kilos cost, I don't know what it is in dollars, but it's like 40 pounds here, 44 pounds or something. Produces 40 liters of alkalinity. So yeah, it's going to be a little more expensive than a calcium reactor or maybe even calc, okay? Little bit more. But let me just contrast this with a few subtle things. Look at your cost of your initial cost of capital to get a calcium reactor and a stirrer up. How many years of boiling light would that pay for? Calcium reactors ain't cheap. They're not cheap to purchase. And actually, when you come to maintain them, they're not that cheap either. You know, the media is not cheap. The CO2 you have to keep replenishing. Okay, if you've got a good source, you can get it cheap. But stirrers are not cheap either. Right? Peristaltic pumps are not cheap. Now, what I would say is the number of occurrences where a calcium reactor blocks and is no longer dosing, and you can have some really catastrophic problems, you know, or a calc stirrer fails and your tank is addicted to calc, and then you can start losing corals. So there's risks with that. I consider calcium reactors, for the reasons that you stated earlier, to be Stone Age technology. I've said this before, because you've got amazing imprecision. You cannot be precise with a calcium reactor. You have no idea how much trace you're putting in. You can't really be precise about how much calcium or alkalinity you're putting in. You've got no real control over how the pH is going to be affected in the tank. Same with the with calc. Okay, with calc, you're actually changing other parameters because when you're putting calc in, you're stripping trace elements. And those trace elements cost you money. Fluoride's not cheap. Okay. So when you actually look at it side by side, suddenly the dosing system, the boiling light system, works out cheaper, less cost of capital, and you're not having to dose all these extra additional components to try and deal with all the side effects of that dosing system. Plus, you can be absolutely precise. When you dose the amount of calcium that you're putting in, you know exactly how much you're putting in. You cannot do that with a calcium reactor or calc. Does that answer it?
Makes sense. No, I get it. Yeah, I think it's a thing where if what's going on is what you're saying true in terms of the precipitation absorbing valuable trace elements, that I understand the point in terms of I do dose a lot of fluoride to my tanks, so that can add up. So there are pieces that add up. I think it's always been a hesitation in terms of the cost of entry. I think in terms of dosing multiple parts versus doing a calcium and dosing calc water. I think that has just been a thing that is a perception that is a pretty common perception, at least here in the United States, is that you're going to save money by going the calcium reactor calc water route.
Been there, done it. I've got wardrobes full of the t-shirts. I run a farm. I keep an eye on the costs very, very, carefully here. The costs of running the farm with boiling light is cheaper than with calcium reactors. So here's the other thing that people don't consider is the fault tolerance, redundancy as well. So you've got single pieces of equipment. If they fail, you've got a problem, right? You could argue the same thing. Well, it's a doser, right? All I need for doing bolus is a doser. Well, okay, put two doses in and split the two. Split the dose between the two. Use two different heads. You've got all sorts of combinations of things that deal with redundancy. As long as the liquids are there, you can find ways of dealing with potential risks. Let's say you run a coral farm and you don't want it to run out of alkalinity. Not a problem, So a lot of those arguments sort of disappear. I think the cost argument is a bit of a silly one because when you actually look into the cost of boiling light, it's not that expensive. If you're running a big tank, Claude has a system called Big Reef. So you have to join the Reefers Club, which is an exclusive group of fauna users. And then you can buy bulk purchases of 25 kilo tubs of all of the salts and the 5 liter tubs of the traces and things like that.
Gotcha.
And then it works out. Then it works out a great deal cheaper. So
one other thing I wanted to bring up in terms of the you mentioned the equipment and I think maintenance is a key, right? With bolus, if you're using a peristaltic dosing pump to do that big alk dump, you got to make sure that you keep up in the maintenance, because if not, and those peristaltic dosing pumps fail, that's not a good thing either.
Yeah. Pick a good one.
Yeah.
We use GHL.
Yeah, me too.
You still need to change the tubes. I did one yesterday.
Yeah.
I did one yesterday. So bolus puts a lot of pressure on the pump. Here we're dosing nearly a liter of alkalinity all at once. So that pump is working pretty hard in the morning.
Yeah. Are you using the Maxi or the regular doser?
No, I'm just using the 2.1.
Oh, really? I've got the Maxi dosers dosing calc water right now, so they can handle a lot of that volume.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's you need to look at the speed at which it's dosing it. You don't want to dose it too quickly.
Yeah.
But the 2.1s work just great for bolus.
Interesting. Okay. Good.
And we use the KHD here as well. We do hourly testing of the alcohol. So all of the research that we did on bolus was done with GHL.
You're doing hourly. You're still doing hourly testing on the alkalinity. Wow, you've gone through a lot of reagent.
Yeah.
Yeah. I only do it 2 times a day. Are you doing it hourly just to keep make sure that the bolus is doing what it's supposed to be doing?
I'm constantly at a stage where we've got another thing that we're working on. I've got 5 or 6 different things in the pipeline that takes us to the next level.
Okay.
So for example, you mentioned ammonium bicarbonate. There's something interesting we're working on in that area as well. And we're trying to use, obviously they're using the GHL stuff to determine what the changes in the rate of consumption is of the alkalinity. So I think for the foreseeable future, I'll be doing hourly dosing. I'd love to do every half an hour, but GHL won't let me.
Well, you can probably have a good supply of maintenance kits for the rollers and the tubes and all that stuff. So yeah, I hear you. All right. Well, listen, Doug, man, I want to wrap it up. Any final thoughts before we sign off here?
Oh, it's just great to be on. And I think the work you've done over the years on this show is tremendous. And keep up the good work. I think the more we can spread, the more knowledge we can spread about the hobby, less loss of corals. Fantastic. So, I think it's just great to be part of your show.
Well, I appreciate...
I've been reef bummed.
You've been... I appreciate you taking the time, man. Do you want to give a shout out to any thing you want to shout out to?
I shout all day long. I don't think I need to shout anymore.
Well, how about visit fragfarm.co.uk and advisory services and all that fun.
We're online only, fragfarm, fragfarm.co.uk. If you want to have some help with ICPs, when you select, when you register your sample, you can select an ICP consultant. ReefBum is available in the US. And other good consultants are available too. You can, if you're in the US, you can pick FragFarm as well. What I tend to do is give a quick 5-point assessment. It will be very crude and rough assessment of your ICP for free. So I'll say, watch out for this, look out for that, do this. And if you need any more assistance, then you can purchase my time in 20-minute blocks through the website. And like I say, we've fixed hundreds of tanks over the years. So it's a very satisfying thing when I get customers come back and say, wow, you fixed that for me. That's great.
Awesome. All right, Doug. Well, listen, man, cool. Thanks again. Appreciate it. I also want to thank my sponsors one more time, Polo Reef. Make sure to check out Polo Reef's new YouTube video that drops this Friday, where the Polo team goes over updates from the infamous 900-gallon glass drop-down tank from breaking in transit, then redelivered the Scape and inhabitants. Find out what's been going on with this crazy aquarium. Make sure to subscribe to their YouTube channel at Polo Reef for video drop notifications. Champion Lighting and Supply, besides being a place for hobbyists to purchase saltwater aquarium supplies online, Champion Lighting is also a wholesale distributor for many popular brands. If you own an aquarium store or an aquarium service company, contact Champion Lighting through their website at championlighting.com to set up a wholesale account. And finally, Polyp Lab, they do their part by being ecologically responsible, using less plastic and more recyclable material. ReefRoids is backed by science and uses 100% ocean-sourced ingredients. No filler, no OGM, no gimmick. Polyp Lab, straight results, the best choice for your marine collection. See the ReefRoids difference for yourself. I want to let you know that all episodes of Wrapping the Reef Bum are available as podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Amazon. My next Wrapping with Reef Bum show, which will be a live stream again, will be on Tuesday, November 5th at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. My guest will be Walt Smith from Walt Smith International in Fiji. You can check out the full upcoming schedule of guests on Reef Bum under the YouTube section. Until next time, be safe and be well. Later.